content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the February 5th, 2016 issue of the Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Oregon militia standoff turns deadly. What happened? The standoff between an Oregon militia and the federal government erupted into violence this week when FBI and state police attempted to arrest the group's leaders at a highway traffic stop, sparking a shootout that left one militiaman dead and eight under arrest. The militia had been occupying the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge since early January to protest the imprisonment of two local ranchers for arson on federal land and to demand the return of federally owned land to locals. Militia leader Ammon Bundy, the son of Cliven Bundy, the Nevada rancher who led an armed standoff against the federal government in 2014, and several occupiers were driving to a community meeting when they were stopped by police. Gunfire broke out, and the group's spokesman, Arizona rancher Robert Lavoy Finnicum, 55, was shot dead. Bundy and seven others were arrested. Federal agents quickly sealed off the remote wildlife refuge and called for the remaining occupiers to depart as part of a peaceful resolution. One of the occupiers, Jason Patrick, said the militia wouldn't leave without a fight. "I've heard peaceful resolution for weeks," Patrick said. "Now there's a cowboy who is my friend who is dead. So prepare for the peaceful resolution." What the columnist said: "Finnicum's death is a tragedy and a waste," said the Phoenix, Arizona Republic in an editorial. "Like many ranchers, miners, and loggers, Finnicum was frustrated by the federal government's control of millions of acres of land in the West, much of which has been turned into environmental refuges rather than given to locals to make a living. And he was right. The question of whether some or all of the federal land should be turned over to the states is an argument worth having. But it's an argument that can't be resolved by armed men taking over a wildlife refuge. Besides, locals' patience was wearing thin," said Charles Pierce in Esquire.com. "The bird sanctuary was becoming a magnet for every gun-toting nativist crackpot west of the Mississippi, and armed militiamen were freely parading around nearby communities. This was something no sensible government could possibly allow." The FBI initially kept a low profile, hoping to avoid the bloodshed that ended the Waco and Ruby Ridge standoffs in the 1990s, said David Graham in TheAtlantic.com. But perhaps violence was inevitable, given the militia's unrealistic demand that the government hand over the refuge. "The question now is whether the arrests of Finnicum's and Finnicum's death will convince the remaining occupiers of the futility of holding out." "Don't bank on it," said Amber Phillips in WashingtonPost.com. "The rancher's death will likely feed the protesters' us versus them view of federal authorities and could make future standoffs with anti-government militias more difficult to solve peacefully." Finnicum had told reporters that he wanted to defend freedom and would rather die than go to jail. "And militia members will want to honor their fallen comrades' belief. The anti-Fed movement now has a martyr." And a second main story: Bloomberg weighs an independent White House run. What happened? Former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg is reportedly considering a possible third-party presidential bid, a wild card that could further roil one of the most unpredictable races in recent memory. Sources told the New York Times last week that the billionaire businessman who has flirted with White House runs before is said to be appalled by the rise of GOP frontrunner Donald Trump and troubled by Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' strong leftist challenge to Hillary Clinton. Founder and CEO of the financial services and media company that bears his name, Bloomberg, 73, was a longtime Democrat, ran for New York City mayor as a Republican, then became an independent. Considered a fiscal conservative, he holds liberal views on abortion and immigration and is an outspoken advocate for gun control. Sources say Bloomberg, who is worth an estimated $36.5 billion, is prepared to spend $1 billion of his own money on a campaign, but will jump into the race only if it boils down to Sanders against either Trump or Texas Senator Ted Cruz. If Hillary wins the nomination, Hillary is mainstream enough that Mike would have no chance, suggests former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell, a Clinton ally. Bloomberg will decide whether to run by early March, the latest point at which he could secure ballot spots in all 50 states. What the columnist said. Bloomberg could make Trump president, said Jamel Bowie in Slate.com. Nearly 60% of Democrats call themselves either moderate or conservative, and many are swing state suburban whites who help make or break the party in national elections. Running as an independent, Bloomberg could siphon off enough of them to hand the White House to someone he clearly loathes. He might even capture some alienated moderate Republicans, said James Toronto in the Wall Street Journal. But broadening his appeal among conservatives will be tough. Bloomberg likely has too much integrity to modify his liberal stances on abortion, gun control, and other issues out of political expediency. Bloomberg's sober pragmatism could inspire the other candidates to tone down the drama and red meat, said the Minneapolis Star-Tribune in an editorial. That would be a welcoming change in a contest with a surfeit of show and little substance. Bloomberg could also trumpet his record as a solid, competent mayor, said Nicole Grelinas in NYTimes.com. He ran a complex, diverse city for 12 years with pragmatic efforts to create more jobs and better infrastructure, all while keeping the city safe. But he won't actually run, said Paul Waldman in the Washington Post. When you're as rich as Bloomberg, you can explore lots of things without being serious, and paying for a few consultants and exploratory polls just doesn't signal much. I bet Bloomberg thinks he'd be an excellent president, but he's smart enough to know there hasn't been a successful third-party candidacy in modern American history. Even by the standards of this wacky race, there's no reason to believe 2016 would be any different. And our controversy of the week, Flint. Who's to blame for the lead in the water? It isn't hard to figure out who is to blame for the disaster in Flint, Michigan, where the drinking water exposed thousands of people to high levels of toxic lead, said Tony Norman in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Michigan's Republican Governor Rick Snyder ran for office on a mandate to cut government spending, and it turns out he was deadly serious. 2 years ago, the cash-strapped city of Flint had its drinking water switched from Michigan's Lake Huron to the brown toxic stew of its own Flint River. Residents complained immediately of rashes, hair loss, and other health problems. But most of the residents are black and poor, and not inclined to vote Republican. It took more than a year before state officials finally admitted that the corrosive river water was leaching lead from Flint's ancient pipe network, exposing the city's children to a toxin that can lower a victim's IQ and cause behavioral disorders and neurological problems. Michigan's Department of Environmental Quality could have prevented the contamination with a simple additive costing $100 a day. Governor Snyder has apologized, said Charles Pierce in Esquire.com, but he should also resign. A city in his state was poisoned on his watch. Governor Snyder took responsibility because that's what leaders do, said David French in NationalReview.com. But this is not a Republican scandal. So far, it's proving easier to find Bigfoot than to identify the person who actually ordered Flint's switch to river water. But we do know that Flint's Democratic City Council, desperate to save money after decades of its own fiscal mismanagement, put it under the control of an emergency manager, approved the switch to the Flint River by a 7-1 vote. President Obama must also be held accountable, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. His Environmental Protection Agency first detected elevated lead levels back in March 2015. Rather than alert the public right away, however, the EPA spent 6 months meekly prodding Michigan officials to do something without warning the public it was drinking poisoned water. There's plenty of blame to go around, says Paul Krugman in NYTimes.com. But it's Snyder and his anti-government ideology that made the disaster possible. Clean drinkable water is a public good to which all citizens are entitled. Actually providing it, though, requires the kind of spending and regulation that Tea Partiers like Snyder equate with big government tyranny. Actually, the Flint disaster is a perfect illustration of what's wrong with big government, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. There were so many layers of bureaucracy supposedly watching over Flint's water supply that no one agency felt responsible. When the problem did not come to light, when the problem did come to light, it took months for the tangle of agencies to respond. Let's give the government bureaucracy some credit, said David Mastio in USA Today. The Flint fiasco has left 10.6% of the city's 8,000 children with blood lead levels of more than 5 micrograms per deciliter. Back in the 1970s, however, 88% of all children in America had blood lead levels in excess of 10 micrograms per deciliter. Then the federal government banned lead in paint and gasoline, and both Republicans and Democratic administrations adopted strict regulations on lead in air, water, and plumbing fixtures. So let's take a deep breath and put what happened to Flint in context. A few decades ago, most Americans would have counted themselves lucky to have the blood lead levels of Flint residents today. Moreover, the fact that the nation is rightly outraged there is any lead in Flint's water is a testament to one of the greatest public health and environmental triumphs in U.S. history. Well, it was a good week for doing the math after a computer at the University of Central Michigan discovered the largest prime number, 2^74,207,281^-1, which consists of more than 22 million digits and is only divisible by 1 and itself. Writing the number by hand would take 3 months and require 7,000 sheets of paper. It was a good week for the Scandinavian way after a survey by Transparency International found that the least corrupt countries in the world are Denmark, Finland, and Sweden. Somalia and North Korea are the most corrupt. And it was a good week for smart people after researchers in Scotland revealed that people with high IQs are less likely to suffer ailments such as diabetes, heart disease, and Alzheimer's, indicating that mental and physical health are closely interconnected. But it was a bad week for Arabian Nights after Saudi Arabia's top cleric, Grand Mufti Sheikh Abdulaziz al-Sheikh, issued a fatwa against chess, saying it causes hostility and wastes time and is the work of Satan. It was a bad week for personal security after an Italian woman called the local fire department because she had lost the key to her chastity belt, The firefighters were able to break the iron clasp, which the woman said she donned to prevent herself from succumbing to temptation. And it was a bad week for the human race. After a new survey by the Barna Group concluded that many teens, young women, and older adults now rely on online pornography for gratification because it's less risky than actual sex. The briefing page article this week, titled "Saudi Arabia at a Crossroads." The House of Saud is crushing dissent and cutting benefits at home while intervening militarily abroad. Why? Are the Saudis nervous? Very. The royal family feels threats from within the country and without as the price of oil plunges. The predominantly young population grows restless, and Saudi Arabia's bitter rival, Shiite Iran, seeks to expand its influence throughout the region. The Saudis were also deeply alarmed by the Arab Spring, which saw long-established regimes crumble, the U.S.'s nuclear deal with Iran, and the rise of ISIS. Since King Salman took the throne a year ago, Saudi authorities have intensified government repression to a severe degree. Now, counterterrorism legislation, enacted shortly before he took power, defines terrorism as any act with criminal intent that undermines public order, as well as any deviant thought that questions Wahhabism, the fundamentalist sect of Sunni Islam that dominates all aspects of Saudi life. What is the impact of this law? Any form of dissent is being prosecuted as a crime. Executions are at a two-decade high, with more than 150 public beheadings in 2015 and 47 in just the first week of this year, including the execution of a prominent Shiite cleric, an act that led Iran to sever diplomatic ties. For urging Saudi society to be more liberal and secular, prominent blogger Raif Badawi was flogged, and his lawyer was jailed for defending him. When the lawyer's wife complained on Twitter about his arrest, she was jailed too. Who's pushing this crackdown? A new group of leaders. The House of Saud has been led by elderly sons of modern Saudi Arabia's founder, Ibn Saud, for many decades. But King Salman, 80, has chosen not to name one of his younger half-brothers as his likely successor. Instead, he appointed his son, Mohammed bin Salman Al Saud, 30, as deputy crown prince and defense minister. And Mohammed is clearly the real power behind the throne. Unlike the older U.S.-educated generation, Mohammed went to a Saudi university, has had little exposure to Western culture, and has a reputation for arrogance and ruthlessness, said Bruce Riedel of the Brookings Institution. What has Mohammed done? The young prince plunged straight into a war in Yemen. The previous cautious diplomatic stance of the older leaders within the royal family is being replaced by a new, impulsive policy of intervention, said a report from the German Foreign Intelligence Service, BND. Saudi Arabia is locked in a struggle with Iran for primacy in the Middle East. The rise of a Shiite government in Iraq brought that country firmly into the Iranian camp, and Lebanon was already there. The conflict in Syria has become a proxy war between the Assad regime, backed by Iran, and militias funded by the Saudis. So when Shiite Houthi militants toppled the Yemeni government, Mohammed moved in swiftly to prevent his country from being bookended by Shiite powers. Saudi airstrikes have killed thousands of Yemeni civilians, but the prince has been undeterred. What about domestic policy? Mohammed says he plans sweeping market-based economic reforms. For 80 years, the Saudi economy has been based almost entirely on oil revenue. High oil prices brought in enormous wealth, which enables the government to fund a generous welfare state without levying any income tax. Most actual work is done by foreigners. A vast army of nearly 9 million immigrants from South Asia and the Middle East, who serve some 18 million Saudis. Saudis are employed largely in the bloated public sector, many of them drawing fat salaries for little work. But this model is becoming unsustainable. People under 25 make up more than half the population, and there aren't enough jobs for them as they reach working age. Worse, the collapse in oil prices from $115 a barrel in 2014 to under $35 now means there isn't enough money flowing in to sustain benefits at such generous levels. Why not? In the past, when oil prices have fallen, the Saudis have cut production to raise them. But this time, they've kept pumping with abandon. The goal is to preserve Saudi market share by driving higher-cost oil producers, notably the U.S. fracking industry, out of business. But the sharp drop in revenue requires painful cuts to the subsidies and the expense accounts that so many Saudis rely on. How will the Saudis react to those cuts? That's one of the things worrying the royal family. The Saudi people have long had a tacit agreement with their rulers. In return for a cushy life and generous benefits, they put up with an almost total lack of political freedom or say in their own government. Many Saudis are rich enough to skip off to Bahrain or Dubai for the weekend, where they can drink alcohol and the women can shed their burqas. Most, though, are middle class, and around one-fifth are actually poor. And if Mohammed makes good on his pledge to replace the free health care system with an insurance-based system and partially privatize education, they will suffer. With a decline in social spending and a reduction in subsidies, says analyst Alberto Gallo, comes the risk of rising domestic turmoil. The oppressed Shiite minority. The Saudi regime said it executed Shiite cleric Nimr al-Nimr for terrorism. But critics said the real reason was his activism in organizing the Shiite minority and denouncing the House of Saud. Shiites make up 15% of the population in Saudi Arabia, and they are strongly discriminated against. They are excluded from the cushy government jobs. And Saudi television and Saudi clerics routinely spread anti-Shiite propaganda. For 3 years, activists in the oil-rich eastern province of Al-Asah, a budding Shiite-majority Bahrain, have been protesting, sometimes violently. You are now standing on top of oil fields that feed the whole world, Shiite activist Fatil al-Safwani told the BBC. But we see nothing of it. Poverty, hunger, no honor, no political freedom, we have nothing. By executing Nimr, the House of Saud sent a clear signal that nothing will change. Indeed, even complaining about anti-Shiite discrimination will get you beheaded. And in our survey of the best columns of the week, we'll take one from the U.S. America's past versus its future. The U.S.'s two political parties have come to represent different editions of the same country. One from the past, one from the future, said Ronald Brownstein. Republicans now depend almost entirely on white voters, who provided 90% of Republican votes in the 2012 primaries and presidential election. The last time whites represented 90% of the total American population was 1960. voters of color provided 45% of Barack Obama's votes in 2012, a percentage that ethnic and racial minorities won't reach until about the year 2030. On religion, marriage rates, gun ownership, and levels of education, the demographic pattern is the same. Republican voters resemble the America of decades ago, while Democrats look like the country that America might become in the decades ahead. As a result, Republicans have become the party of restoration. Their candidates promise to roll back the cultural and political changes of recent decades. Democrats, on the other hand, are the party of transformation, with candidates promising even more dramatic change. This makes for a dangerously divided nation. Social and demographic changes that are as irreversible as tides are now colliding with the values so many cultural conservative Americans fear are endangered. This from the United Kingdom. London, world city or third world? London is no longer an English city, said Harriet Sargent. It's not just that nearly 40% of the capital's residents were born abroad. It's that the tide of immigration has swamped the city since 2001, has brought with it foreign criminal gangs, massive homelessness, and conditions of unimaginable squalor, misery, and criminality. In his new book, This is London, Life and Death in the World City, war correspondent Ben Judah exposes this underworld. Women and underage girls trafficked from Eastern Europe are forced into prostitution. Poles and Romanians are sleeping rough on the streets. Many migrants transported here by criminal gangs are forced to work as virtual slaves to pay off their passage with interest. One youth from Grenada, who came looking for honest work and ended up dealing and using cocaine, told Judah that London was way more corrupt, way more dangerous, more full of disillusion than anywhere in Grenada. Somali gangs terrorize estates in South London, while Turkish gangs control North London. They all compete with Vietnamese drug dealers and the Kurdish and Albanian mafias. Even on the wealthy side of town, the English are retreating, pushed out by super-rich Russians, Chinese, and Arabs. London is now a foreign city with extremes of foreign poverty and wealth. And this from China. Why booksellers are vanishing. A chill has descended on Hong Kong's once thriving banned book industry, said Jennifer Lowe. For decades, a small group of publishers and bookshops in this semi-autonomous region of China have made a tidy profit selling books on topics considered taboo by Beijing: political corruption, religion, the love lives of Communist Party officials, to curious mainland visitors. But the mysterious disappearance of five Hong Kong booksellers over the past few months may prove to be the industry's death knell. You don't want to risk your life just to get a book published, said publisher Jin Zhang, before leaving Hong Kong to join his family in the U.S. It all began last October when Hong Kong publisher Gui Minhai, a Chinese-born Swedish national, disappeared while vacationing in Thailand, said Matthias Mueller. Around the time, three employees of Gui's mighty current publishing house vanished during separate trips to the mainland. Then a business partner of Gui's, Li Bo, went missing on December 30th, apparently kidnapped from Hong Kong itself. Suspicion instantly fell on Beijing, as Mighty Current had been planning to publish a book on President Xi Jinping's alleged extramarital affairs and had already put out the provocatively titled The Collapse of Xi Jinping in 2017. Sure enough, Chinese authorities admitted last week that Li and Gui, at least, were in detention in China. Gui was last seen on state TV, tearfully claiming that he turned himself in for a drunk driving offense committed 12 years ago on the mainland. No one is fooled, said Michael Chugani in the South China Morning Post. The abductions were clearly aimed at silencing critics. Still, they may not have been ordered by the president. It's unlikely Xi would have approved an operation that risked alienating people of Hong Kong. They are furious at such a blatant breach of the One Country, Two Systems protocol agreed to when the former British colony returned to Chinese rule in 1997, which stated that Beijing would not interfere with Hong Kong's freewheeling capitalism and democracy. The kidnappings were most likely carried out by lower-level officials eager to please their bosses. On the contrary, the detentions are of a piece with Xi's ongoing crackdown, said Anurag Vishwanath in the Financial Express. Over on the mainland, all dissidents who challenge the government's human rights abuses are at risk. Human rights lawyers and activists have been disappearing with grim regularity, while prominent bloggers have been arrested and charged with trumped-up crimes. Rest assured, the suppression comes straight from Xi. Unlike his presidential predecessors, Xi wears all three hats in the Chinese leadership: party as general secretary, state as president, and military as chairman of the Central Military Commission. He has more power than any leader of modern China, including Mao. If he is determined to crush dissent, that could mean the end of Hong Kong's special freedoms. And the last word, our in-depth article, this week titled, What's Your Threat Score? Police are testing data programs that instantly assess your potential for violence based on your arrest history, Facebook posts, and other records. Journalist Justin Juvenal looks at the future of high-tech policing. While officers in Fresno, California, raced to a recent 9/11 call about a man threatening his ex-girlfriend, a police operator in headquarters consulted software that scored the suspect's potential for violence the way a bank might run a credit report. The program scoured billions of data points, including arrest reports, property records, commercial databases, deep web searches, and the man's social media postings. It calculated his threat level as the highest of three color-coded scores, a bright red warning. The man had a firearm conviction and a gang association. So out of caution, police called a negotiator. The suspect surrendered, and police said the intelligence helped them make the right call. It turned out he had a gun. As a national debate has played out over mass surveillance by the National Security Agency, a new generation of technology like the Beware software being used at Fresno has given local law enforcement officers an unprecedented power to peer into the lives of citizens. Police officials say such tools provide critical information that can help uncover terrorists or thwart mass shootings, ensure the safety of officers and the public, find suspects, and crack open cases. They say that last year's attacks in San Bernardino, California, and Paris have only underscored the need for such measures. But the powerful systems have also become flashpoints for civil libertarians and activists who say they represent a troubling intrusion on privacy, have been deployed with little public oversight, and have potential abuse or error, have potential for abuse or error. Some say laws are needed to protect the public. In many instances, people have been unaware that the police around them are sweeping up information, and that has spawned controversy. Planes outfitted with cameras filmed protests and unrest in Ferguson, Missouri, and Baltimore. For years, dozens of departments used devices that can hoover up all cell phone data in an area without search warrants. Authorities in Oregon are facing an internal investigation after using social media monitoring software to keep tabs on Black Lives Matter hashtags. This is something that's been building since September 11th, said Jennifer Lynch, a senior staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. First, funding went to the military to develop this technology, and now it has come back to domestic law enforcement. It's the perfect storm of cheaper and easier to use technologies and money from state and federal governments to purchase it. Few departments will say how, or sometimes if, they are using these tools, but the Fresno police offered a rare glimpse inside a cutting-edge $600,000 nerve center, even as a debate raged in the city over its technology. Fresno's real-time crime center is the type of facility that has become the model for high-tech policing nationwide. Similar centers have opened in New York City, Houston, and Seattle over the past decade. Fresno's futuristic control room, which operates around the clock, sits deep in police headquarters and brings together a handful of technologies that allow the department to see, analyze, and respond to incidents as they unfold across the city of more than 500,000 in the San Joaquin Valley. On a recent Monday afternoon, the center was a hive of activity. The police radio crackled over loudspeakers. Subject armed with steel rod, as five operators sat behind banks of screens, dialing up a wealth of information to help units respond to more than 1,200 911 calls the department receives every day. On 57 monitors that cover the walls of the center, operators zoomed and panned an array of roughly 200 police cameras perched across the city. They could dial up 800 more feeds from the city's schools and traffic cameras, and they hope to soon add 400 more streams from cameras worn on officers' bodies and from thousands of local businesses that have surveillance systems. The cameras were only one tool at the ready. Officers could trawl a private database that has recorded more than 2 billion scans of vehicles' license plates and locations nationwide. If gunshots were fired, a system called ShotSpotter could triangulate the location using microphones strung around the city. Another program called Media Sonar crawled social media looking for illicit activity. Police used it to monitor individuals, threats to schools, and hashtags related to gangs. Fresno police have said having the ability to access all that information in real time is crucial to solving crimes. They recently used the cameras to track a robbery suspect as he fled a business and then jumped into a canal to hide. He was quickly apprehended. The license plate database was instrumental in solving a September murder case in which police had a description of a suspect's vehicle and three numbers from the license plate. But perhaps the most controversial and revealing technology is the threat scoring software Beware. Fresno is one of the first departments in the nation to test it. As officials respond to calls, Beware automatically runs the address. The searches return the names of residents and scans them against a range of publicly available data to generate a color-coded threat level for each person or address: green, yellow, or red. Exactly how Beware calculates threat scores is something that its maker, Intrado, considers a trade secret. So it is unclear how much weight is given to a misdemeanor, felony, or threatening comment on Facebook. However, the program flags issues and provides a report to the user. In promotional materials, Intrado writes that Beware could reveal that the resident of a particular address was a war veteran suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, had criminal convictions for assault, and had posted worrisome messages about his battle experiences on social media. The big data that has transformed marketing and other industries has now come to law enforcement. Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer said officers are often working on scant or even inaccurate information when they respond to calls. So Beware and the Real-Time Crime Center give them a sense of what may be behind the next door. Our officers are expected to know the unknown and see the unseen, Dyer said. They are making split-second decisions based on limited facts. The more you can provide in terms of intelligence and video, the more safely you can respond to calls. But some in Fresno say the power and the sheer concentration of surveillance in the real-time crime center is troubling. The concerns have been raised elsewhere as well. Last year, Oakland City officials scaled back plans for such a center after residents protested, citing privacy concerns. Rob Nabarro, a Fresno civil rights lawyer, said he is particularly concerned about Beware. He said outsourcing decisions about the threat posed by an individual to software is a problem waiting to happen. Nabarro said the fact that only Entrato, not the police or the public, knows how Beware tallies its score is disconcerting. He also worries that the system might mistakenly increase someone's threat level by misinterpreting innocuous activity on social media, like criticizing the police, and trigger a heavier response by officers. It's a very unrefined, gross technique, Nabarro said, of Beware's color-coded levels. A police call is something that can be very dangerous for a citizen. Dyer believes such concerns are overblown, saying the scores don't trigger a particular police response. He said operators use them as guides to delve more deeply into someone's background, looking for information that might be relevant to an officer on the scene. He also said officers on the street never see the scores. Still, Nabarro is not the only one worried. The Fresno City Council called a hearing on Beware in November after constituents raised concerns. One council member referred to a local media report saying that a woman's threat level was elevated because she was tweeting about a card game titled Rage, which could be a keyword in Beware's assessment of social media. Councilman Clinton J. Oliver, a libertarian-leaning Republican, said Beware was like something out of a dystopian science fiction novel and asked Dyer a simple question. Could you run my threat level now? Dyer agreed. The scan returned Oliver as a green, but his home came back as a yellow, possibly because someone who previously lived at his address, a police official said. Even though it's not me that's the yellow guy, your officers are going to treat whoever comes out of the house in his boxer shorts as the yellow guy, Oliver said. That may not be fair to me. He added later that Beware has failed right here with a council member as an example. An Entrato representative responded to an interview request seeking more information about how Beware works by sending a short statement. It read, in part, Beware works to quickly provide officers with commercially available public information that may be relevant to the situation and may give them a greater level of awareness. Similar debates over police surveillance have been playing out across the country as new technologies have proliferated and gun enforcement use has exploded. And law enforcement use has exploded. The number of local police departments that employ some type of technological surveillance increased from 20% in 1997 to more than 90% in 2013, according to the latest information from the Bureau of Justice Statistics. The most common forms of surveillance are cameras and automated license plate readers. But the use of handheld biometric scanners, social media monitoring software, devices that collect cell phone data, and drones is increasing. The American Civil Liberties Union reports that police in Washington, D.C. and Baltimore have cell phone data collectors called cell site simulators or stingrays. D.C. police are also using ShotSpotter and license plate readers. The surveillance creates vast amounts of data, which is increasingly pooled in local, regional, and national databases. The largest such project is the FBI's $1 billion Next Generation Identification Project, which is creating a trove of fingerprints, iris scans, data from facial recognition software, and other sources that aid local departments in identifying suspects. Law enforcement officials say such tools allow them to do more with less, and they have credited the technology with providing breaks in many cases. Virginia State Police found the man who killed a TV news crew during a live broadcast last year after his license plate was captured by a reader. Cell site simulators, which mimic a cell phone tower and scoop up data on all cell phones in an area, have been instrumental in finding kidnappers, fugitives, and people who are suicidal, law enforcement officials said. But those benefits have sometimes come with a cost to privacy. Law enforcement used cell site simulators for years without getting a judge's explicit consent. But following criticism from the ACLU and other groups, the Justice Department announced last September that it would require all federal agencies to get a search warrant. The fact that public discussion of surveillance technologies is occurring after they are in use is backward, said Matt Cagle, an attorney for the ACLU of Northern California. We think that whenever these surveillance technologies are on the table, there needs to be a meaningful debate, Cagle said. There needs to be safeguards and oversight. After the contentious hearing before the Fresno City Council on Beware, Dyer said he now wants to make the changes to address residents' concerns. The police chief said he is working with Entrato to turn off Beware's color-coded rating system and possibly the social media monitoring. There's a balancing act, Dyer said. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. We're on the health and science page now. A grander canyon in Antarctica. The world's largest canyon may lie hidden under several miles of ice in East Antarctica's Princess Elizabeth Land, one of the last unexplored land surfaces on Earth, a new study reveals. Using satellite images and radio waves, scientists discovered evidence of a vast chasm up to 3,280 feet deep and 680 miles long, twice the length of the Grand Canyon and nearly as deep. The canyon, which may be connected to a massive subglacial lake, was likely carved out by water flowing beneath the Antarctic ice sheet. It will take more direct and detailed measurements to confirm the canyon's existence, but geologists are astonished that such a massive geological feature remained undetected for so long. This is a region of the Earth that is bigger than the UK, and yet we still know little about what lies beneath the ice, said researcher Stuart Jameson, tells CBSNews.com. In fact, the bed of Antarctica is less well known than the surface of Mars. Scientists say it's critical to understand the hidden landscape of Antarctica to understand how its ice sheets will react in a warming world. The health scare of the week. Zika prompts travel warnings. Pregnant women should delay traveling to Mexico, Central America, South America, and the Caribbean and Polynesia due to outbreaks of the Zika virus in these regions, cautions the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Furthermore, expectant mothers who have recently returned from those areas and developed symptoms of Zika, such as fever, rash, joint pain, or red eyes, should be screened for the mosquito-borne disease, which has been linked to severe birth defects in newborns. The warnings were prompted by an unprecedented surge in the number of Brazilian infants born with microcephaly, which renders the head abnormally small and causes irreversible brain damage. It's not yet proven that Zika causes the condition, but the virus has been detected in microcephalic infants. So far, there have been at least a dozen known cases of Zika among returning American travelers. There is no vaccine or treatment, and the only way to prevent the virus is to avoid mosquito bites. The really tough thing here is, for those who may have been infected, nothing can be done. Obstetrician Laura Riley of Massachusetts General Hospital tells CNN.com, "We're hunting and looking for something we can't do anything about." On the Talking Points page, climate change, does 2015 prove it's real? For those still unconvinced about the reality of climate change, the year that just ended should erase any doubt, said Jason Samenow in the Washington Post. In a joint announcement, NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration confirmed last week that 2015 was the warmest year on record for the planet, with global temperatures having risen by a quarter of a degree Fahrenheit. The previous record, set just 12 months ago in 2014, wasn't merely broken, it was smashed. 15 of the 16 warmest years in NOAA's 136-year history have now occurred since 2000. The results are undeniable. Glaciers are melting at a startling rate, sea levels are rising, and extreme weather is becoming increasingly common. The El Niño weather phenomenon is likely to make 2016 even hotter than 2015, said Phil Platt in Slate.com. Sorry, skeptics, but there can no longer be any doubt. The globe is warming. Not so fast, said Patrick Michaels in the Wall Street Journal. Until last summer, most scientists agreed that warming reached its peak in the late 1990s. And then plateaued in a pause or hiatus. But then the NOAA decided to overhaul its data. The agency ditched the satellite readings it had used to measure sea surface temperatures since the late 1970s and began using less accurate measurements taken from ships. Presto, the temperature plateau that had vexed climate alarmists disappeared. Government scientists also make suspicious adjustments to surface measurements instead of releasing raw data to the public, said James Taylor in Forbes.com. Climatologists, in other words, are manipulating the data so it shows what they want it to show. That conspiracy theory is ridiculous, said Scott Johnson in ArsTechnica.com. Surface temperature data has to be adjusted to reflect the fact that different weather stations use different equipment and methods. The raw data alone would actually produce the appearance of more warming, not less. The myth of the pause is now gone, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. But nothing will ever convince the skeptics. Conservatives have a near theological need to deny climate change on philosophical grounds because it can only be addressed by government and the international community and therefore threatens their free market absolutism. Faced with the powerful new evidence, the skeptics just come up with a new talking point. The Oscars, fixing the race problem. Hollywood has a race problem, said Roxane Gay in the New York Times. After a second straight year in which all 20 acting nominees are white, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences is facing a public uproar with hashtag activism, hashtag Oscars so white, Will Smith, Jada Pinkett Smith, and Spike Lee boycotting the awards, and the Academy itself engaging in public soul-searching. The lack of nominations for black actors in Straight Outta Compton, Creed, and other films comes as no surprise, since 94% of Academy voters are white, and most of them are men over 50. But the deeper issue is not Oscar nominations, but the dearth of movies about people of color written and directed by people of color. Why does Hollywood keep churning out movies about white, self-looking for love, living in New York in an improbably large apartment? Why are there so few films that feature people who look like me? The Oscars aren't racist, said Kyle Smith in the New York Post. Over the past 15 years, 10% of acting nominees were black. The black proportion of the population was 12 to 13% in that period, so it's hardly a wild disparity. In recent years, Academy voters gave acting Oscars to Forrest Whitaker, Monique, and Lupita Nyong'o, said William Goldstein in the Los Angeles Times. In 2014, 12 Years a Slave by black filmmaker Steve McQueen won Best Picture. The awards should reward artistic excellence without regard to race. Yet Academy President Cheryl Boone Isaacs has unveiled a radical plan to satisfy the PC mob. To help double minority and female membership by 2020, members will lose voting privileges after 10 years unless they remain active in movies. Obviously, the point is to purge older, presumably white, members and create something akin to affirmative action. That might fix the Academy's grumpy old men problem, said Alinda Wheat in People.com. But the real power in Hollywood will remain with the white studio moguls, who decide what films are made and which directors, producers, and casting agents make them. If people of color aren't in the room, we're voiceless. Until that changes, minority audiences must flock to movies by and about people of color while staying away from all-white films. Movie executives like to claim they're not racist, that it's all business, that their favorite color is green. Let's make them prove it. And one short note. A boom in gun sales, a record 3.3 million weapons in December 2015 alone, has left the federal government overwhelmed by the number of background checks it must perform. The Obama administration says it needs to hire 430 people to keep up. And we'll finish with a quote from novelist William McIlvaney. He says, "We are part animal. Humanity is an aspiration, not a fact of everyday life." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.